Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel, coming to you, as ever, from Sapporo in Japan. Today, we'll be talking to James M. Dorsey, Senior Fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, about his book, China and the Middle East, Venturing into the Maelstrom, which is published this year, 2018, by Palgrave Macmillan. Now, China's rise might seem to a lot of people like old news, or at least a pretty well-established concept in global affairs at large. But given the scale and reach of what we understand under this sort of term, it's pretty difficult to keep up with every aspect of it. Now, the Middle East, among those global locations where China is playing a greater role, perhaps gets less attention at times. Or at the very least, it's somewhere where the role of the United States and other major players, we might include Israel, Saudi Arabia and Iran, as well as other places, get a lot more attention than what's going on in terms of China's activities. So James Dorsey has done us all a great favor here by looking into this subject in detail in what is a pretty comprehensive and rich book presentation. Which also, I should say, moves into other regions too, notably South Asia, where China is also a key player. So without further ado, and to get into some of the subjects treated in China and the Middle East, Venturing into the Maelstrom, I'll say, James Dorsey, welcome to the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you here. And I should mention for listeners, perhaps point them in the direction straight up of your hosted channel, New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, which are also really worth a listen. But perhaps I could begin by asking you about yourself and where you come from. You describe yourself in the preface to the book as a academic or someone with a mixed journalistic and academic background. So perhaps you could say something about that and how you came to your position currently.
Well, thank you very much for that very kind introduction. Indeed, I describe myself as a hackademic, hack being a term that not this generation of journalists, but my generation of journalists use to describe themselves. And to be quite honest, I liberally plagiarize a colleague who is a BBC, former BBC foreign correspondent, turned communications professor at City University in London, who in a bio of himself in an edited volume several years ago described himself as a hackademic. And I thought that's a perfect fit. So my career's been more than four decades of being a foreign correspondent. And I covered ethnic and religious conflict as well as geopolitics across the globe and was based across the globe in Latin America and Europe and Asia and Africa in the United States. And although a heavy emphasis on the Middle East, I was based in 10 countries in the Middle East, some of them even twice or three times.
And who are you working for in these various locations?
I started my career off with a Dutch newspaper, and then went to the Christian Science Monitor. I did a joint stint because of expense when I was based in Kuwait for the New York Times and the Financial Times. But the bulk of my career really was with the Wall Street Journal, mm-hmm. which I left in 2006 when, one, Murdoch was taking over, and I didn't really want to be part of that. I also thought it was time to move on to do other things, and I had just won a landmark libel case in the House of Lords, which was still then the Supreme Court in Britain, which actually contributed to changing British libel law.
What, if you don't mind my asking, was the subject of this case?
Well, I was the first ever foreign correspondent based in Saudi Arabia. So until then, what you had in Saudi Arabia was either foreign nationals working for English language publications in Saudi Arabia who freelanced somewhat circumstantially so as not to expose themselves too much for Western outlets, or you had people coming in and out, and for a very long time that was very difficult to get in. 9/11 prompted a sort of struggle within the ruling family of Saudi Arabia on how to deal and how to respond to 9/11. One faction was hardline, wanted to rally the wagons, close off, and another faction wanted to open up. And that faction basically took me under their wing, one very key person, and arranged for me to be the first foreign correspondent. And as you probably recall at the time, you had a dichotomy in the way the United States administration responded to the Saudis. So you had the White House, the State Department, the Pentagon basically saying, the Saudis are cooperating with us in investigating this and in trying to combat terrorism. And you had the law enforcement agencies and some of the intelligence community saying, they're not cooperating at all. And I did a story, took me 2 months to do it, in which I documented how the Saudis had were monitoring 150 bank accounts of very prominent Saudis, including members of the ruling family, because those accounts in one way or another had been associated with funds that went to questionable entities or people. Hmm. Now, the story very clearly said the monitoring was at the behest of the U.S., but it was not intended to generate litigation. It was intended to send a message to Saudis that, and Saudi donors, that they needed to know where their money was going, and they needed to be more cautious about how that money was distributed, because often what happened, it was just distributed to whoever, and there was no checks and balances. And the story named names, and two of Saudi Arabia's most powerful businessmen took umbrage with that. And so they took me to court in London.
Oh, wow. Oh, well, that sounds like certainly a pretty profound engagement with...
It was my sixth libel case. Right. I've had a seventh since, which I won and changed law or procedures in Singapore.
Oh, well.
And I regularly have encounters with lawyers.
Well, I suppose that's at least suggestive of your getting pretty deeply involved with what's going on in the various societies where you've been living. So you obviously have this kind of pretty long-standing and deep engagement with the Middle East as a journalist. And what point did the transition towards the more academic end of the academic spectrum occur?
Well, I got invited, it's rather funny actually, I got invited in 2011 to join on a fellowship the Middle East Institute at the National University of Singapore. And it was a 6-month fellowship that I walked out of after 3 months, quite brutally, saying, forget it. Hmm. And within an hour on a Saturday evening of my walking out, I was asked if I would join RSAS, the Rajaratnam School of International Studies, as a senior fellow. And they've tolerated me ever since.
I see. I see. And how do you see the relationship between these two worlds in which you've been involved? I mean, academia and I won't call it hackery, but journalism. Times are set as sort of juxtaposed opposites. There's been some recent discussion on Twitter, for example, particularly relating to Xinjiang, which I know we'll get onto during the course of this podcast, about who sacrifices more and who is more constrained in terms of what they can say. And who has to censor themselves more in relation to these kinds of sensitive subjects. How do you see the relationship there between the two spheres, between academia and journalism?
Well, actually, I think it's evolving. For one, traditionally, I think academia looked down on journalists. Mm-hmm. And sort of sat in an ivory tower, if you wish. Whereas, you know, and I actually had an exchange at a conference about 2 years ago, which a very prominent academic whom I know very well held a keynote speech that really was on current affairs rather than history or whatever. But then when I also keynoted, that person attacked me on grounds of journalism. And I basically said, look, first of all, what journalism does is it's an immediate account of current history as it happens. And in that sense, it's absolutely, you know, leave aside the account, you know, accountability function of the media and the Fourth Estate and all of those kind of concepts. That's what people use. That's what they use to understand what's happening and to respond to it. That's one. Two, most journalists, in comparison to few academics, put their life on the line in certain situations. And, you know, I said to this person, I said, look, I have the physical and the mental scars of having covered conflict and having been on the ground as it happened for 40 years. So I don't think you can discount that. The reason I'm saying that it's evolving is that academia is evolving. And so the fault lines between being a scholar and being a public intellectual are blurring. In fact, you're starting to get universities that, in terms of your evaluation, no longer score you exclusively on whether or not you are publishing in tier one publications, but on how popular you are on social media, how frequently you publish non-academically, or how frequently you are consulted or interviewed by media as an expert. So I think that whole relationship and attitudes towards one another are evolving. There are certain things that I insist on that academics do, but maybe in a more restrained fashion or not. And obviously it's a question of resources and things that they don't all do, which are, you know, I spend a good part of the year on the ground. So I travel 60 or 70% of the year. And I'm talking to people in various parts of the world almost daily in various factions. And some of that is difficult because of the circumstances in the countries and regions where they are. And my writing style remains journalistic. And I insist on that. In fact, when I learned a lot about academic publishing, which I find in and of itself onerous, But the first lesson I learned was when I submitted my first article to a tier one journal. And they came back with two peer reviews, which is a system that I have questions about, and a comment by the editor. The comment by the editor was that my style was too journalistic. And so I wrote back and said, that's my style, and I'm not going to change it, so I withdraw the piece. And I got an email 5 minutes back later, 5 minutes later back saying, we accept your piece. And what I realized with that is that part of the onerous structure of academic publishing is that the journal knows you need to publish because your job's on the line. And the moment you take that leverage away, and I've done that repeatedly, and I've actually also changed contracts because they were onerous. What I realized is once you take that leverage away, you can get quite a bit of what you want.
Interesting. Yeah. So I suppose, it seems you've developed a knack of negotiating the boundaries and the limits perhaps of various spheres, whether it's
I learned that at Israeli airports.
Well, perhaps we'll get on to airports and other infrastructural installations as we move on. I mean, perhaps we should really get on to the book now, China and the Middle East. Where did China come in, and how did this book kind of take shape?
Well, I think it has several roots. One was that I realized in the 1990s, in the immediate aftermath of the demise of the Soviet Union, at a time that I was based in Istanbul and covering the Caucasus and Central Asia and was venturing into Xinjiang, that there was a greater Middle East, or West Asia, if you wish, that was not only populated by Arab states, Iran, Turkey, Israel. And that within that greater Middle East, if you wish, there were various worlds. There was the Iranian world, there was the Turkic world, and there was the Arab world. The other, and as I was realizing that and thinking about it, it changed my perspective of my coverage, and which started in the 1970s, of Pakistan and Afghanistan. So those were two of the factors that shaped it, but really sort of in a sense sparked the book were a series of incidents or events in 2011. During the Arab popular Arab revolts, which included that China's approach towards Libya broke with the principle for the first time, at least that I recently recall, of non-interference in the domestic affairs of others, because they established relations with the opposition National Council, didn't quite put the National Council on the same level as government, but nonetheless, there was frequent interaction. When Colonel Gaddafi fell, the Chinese realized that that wasn't good enough, because one of the first things that the post-Gaddafi government told the Chinese is, you're all the way down on the totem pole because you were supporting the regime of Gaddafi for the longest period of time. The second incident that prompted was, first of all, the Chinese had to evacuate 35,000 of their nationals from Libya, which was the first time that they had to have that kind of operation very far from their borders. And they had kidnappings of 25 Chinese nationals in the Sinai Desert in Egypt, as well as a number of Chinese in South Sudan, and had to get them out. And there was almost an outcry at the time on Chinese social media about the fact that the government was really not prepared to protect its nationals overseas, who were expanding in numbers exponentially, as well as its mushrooming interests and investments. And then you had the knife attacks by Uyghur militants in Xinjiang cities like Khotan and Kashgar. And the final event was a what I would call a brutal encounter between Arab businessmen and intellectuals, Chinese intellectuals, some of them in China-based, some of them very close to the Chinese-based at non-Chinese universities, in which the Arabs attacked the Chinese for simply looking at the relationship with the Middle East as one that was, again, based on the principle of win-win, was economically and trade-driven. And the Arabs businessmen were basically saying, you are a rising superpower, if not a superpower, whether you want to recognize that or not. And that carries responsibility with it. And you have to live up to that responsibility. And the Chinese didn't really have an answer to that. And so what all of that together, and then, you got the Belt and Road, and I got, involved in that because I was spending a lot of time in Pakistan at that moment for a book that I'm writing at the moment. And obviously, this is the single largest country investment of China with all its problems in Pakistan. And so what I realized was that, one, the greater Middle East was going to force China to, along with other things, but was going to be one major driver of China throwing all of its fundamental foreign and defense policy principles that it has maintained for decades out the window. And we've seen that already happening. So non-interference, for the first time ever, as far as I can think of, there's been a degree of public, by officials, consideration of a foreign military intervention, not one that is just across the border with outposts in Tajikistan or in Afghanistan, but far from the border, namely in Syria, because of the presence of Uyghurs in the last rebel-held stronghold of Idlib. And the Chinese were actually considering intervening there. So all of these, and then you have the foreign military base that they established in Djibouti, and it's the first of more to come. So in other words, all of these principles were going to go out the door. So that really was then what drove me to sort of think about a book.
Yeah, that's a very kind of new perspective, I think, it may be for many listeners. I mean, I guess when it comes to China's growing presence in the world and its influence in various spheres, lots of people are looking for watersheds, for key moments. And I think coming at it from, as you highlight, this post-2011 Arab Spring, if we want to call it that, events, is a new lens through which to examine sort of what China's place in the world at large might be evolving into. So you've already kind of gestured at these various components that make up the region you call the Greater Middle East, as you say, Turkic, Arab, and also Iranian, Persian components. Could you just say a little more about what you think makes this a region the worth considering together? What are the kind of, or indeed whether it actually is, whether it's just a shorthand, is it something that we can consider as a single region, the Greater Middle East? And is it the case in your perception that China sees it, more importantly, as a single space?
Well, I think there's several things and several ways of coming at this. First of all, if you define the Greater Middle East as stretching from Morocco and North Africa into Xinjiang, you're talking about an enormous swath of land. And even if you just took it from the Gulf to Xinjiang, you're talking about the heart of Eurasia. And if there's one thing that's happening, is we're seeing the return of a supercontinent, in which the lines between Europe and Asia become very blurry. So in that sense, there's no way you can avoid it. Then you, of course, get the issues of what certainly the classical Middle East, if you wish, represents. So one, but also Central Asia, which is enormous energy resources, oil and gas. And even if you're now getting major, maybe even the United States being the largest oil and gas producer, the bulk in terms of the total still comes from that swath of land. On top of that, you've got the geostrategic location of it on the cusp between Europe, Asia, and Africa. And you're seeing that in the political struggles that are going on, the Gulf rivalries that are expanding into the Horn of Africa. And you also have the element that at least four states, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey, and Pakistan, in one way or another, claim to speak on behalf of the Muslim world. So there's no way that you can avoid it. And in that sense, it is a very crucial part of the picture. From the Chinese perspective, I think it's more complex. First of all, as far as I'm concerned, the Chinese do not have a Middle East policy. They articulated for the first time some sort of approach towards the Middle East in January of 2016, when they put out what was called an Arab World Policy white paper, which was published on the eve of President Xi Jinping's visit to the Middle East, the first by a Chinese head of state in 7 years. But when you read that document, it really is a reiteration of platitudes. It's very much focused on economic cooperation and all the various fields and win-win and what have you. It doesn't articulate a position. Sorry. It doesn't articulate a position towards the multiple issues and conflicts that we're witnessing in the Middle East. And I think the thing to keep in mind is, people have moved after 2011 from calling the Arab Spring the Arab Winter. I would argue that the Middle East is in an era of transition. It's volatile, it's brutal, it's violent, but it is in transition. We may not be sure in transition to what. And transitions historically last at least a quarter of a century, sometimes up to half a century. So we're really at the beginning of this, which is where China gets into trouble because, in my mind at least, because as a matter of principle, to me, the Chinese principle of non-interference in domestic affairs of others is no different from U.S. policy in the region, which was support autocratic regimes to maintain stability. And whatever one thinks of George W. Bush, it was actually George W. Bush very shortly after the 9/11 attacks, and then Susan Rice, his national security advisor and later Secretary of State, who said, we're partly responsible for this because of that support of autocracy, which is when Bush launched his ill-fated democracy initiative. And the Chinese are getting it, as Libya demonstrates, are going to get into that same problem. Now, that may not be immediately evident because what you've had in the Middle East, and that's why people call it the Arab Winter, you've had a very forceful counter-revolution led by the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates, which until now has been very successful. But even that, you're starting to see crack.
Well, perhaps we can move on to some of these more fine-grained kind of maneuvers and developments slightly later on. I just wanted to approach again, or sort of bring us back to the scene setting that occurs in the first couple of chapters of the book, the introduction, and then a second chapter entitled Towards a New World Order. You've already set the kind of stage as far as the region that we're discussing here is concerned. But what you describe here in terms that are very different from as the win-win and sort of harmonious language of the Arab policy paper you mentioned there is an epic battle, a 21st century great game, an era of fraught competition in this region. So could you perhaps say more about who the players are? I mean, you've already mentioned them kind of separately, but who are the key players in this battle that you're discussing? How fast are we moving towards the new world order that you mentioned there in the title of that second chapter?
I think I would categorize them in essentially as at the top tier, if you wish, China, Russia, and the United States. And then you have a second tier, Japan, India. And then I'd say you have a third tier, which is Saudi Arabia, Iran, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and to some extent, Israel.
So the local players are in the third tier there, as you see it.
Right. So, with other words, they're not. First of all, their goals are different. Their goals are regional when it comes to this. They're not global, if you wish. Second of all, their interests are far more specific. And that's basically to kick one another out. So the Saudis and the Emiratis don't like the Qataris. The Israelis are ambivalent to the Qataris, but they have, on the one hand, to a degree, common interests with the Saudis and the Emiratis, but they also have differing interests. The Iranians are, in some ways, in an advantageous position, because the Iranians over the next 5 years are going to have a significant surplus in gas. And they will have to cater. Well, they have three main clients: China, Europe, and Turkey. And they will only with that surplus really be able to service two of the three. So how they decide to do that really is going to influence the energy architecture of Eurasia in ways that the other Middle Eastern players cannot do. And obviously, with the U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 international agreement to curb the Iranian nuclear program, and therefore a greater dependency of Iran on China because of the boycott and China's determination alongside other signatories of the agreement to try and salvage it, China certainly is going to come out of that struggle for Iranian favor probably quite well.
Mm-hmm. But is that, as you see it, a rare sign of positive results in the region for China? Or I think at least the broad presentation you give is that it's the likes of China and Russia of that first tier of major players that you're talking about who are quote unquote winning currently this game, if you like. Is China, at least when it comes to a rivalry or a competition with the United States, currently in the ascendancy?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that China is winning.
Okay.
That's one. I think if you go back to the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, a guy from the Middle East in pajamas and a tea towel on his head shows up and his interlocutor's eyes start rolling with dollar signs. I think there's a bit of that now when someone from China shows up. But you're already starting to see a backlash. So with other words, the whole questions of debt trap, being forced to hand over critical assets is starting to spark a significant criticism, and the Chinese are taking note of that. So I don't think that we can talk about this as a pure win. In fact, I would say the jury's still out on that. That's not to say that China's relations with the Middle East are very good, but in fact, the Chinese, you look at Saudi Arabia, for example, one of the Saudi issues that they had with the Obama and Trump administrations was that the Americans will not sell them top-level killer drones. The Chinese are selling it to them, and not only selling it to them, the first Chinese military industry being establishing a manufacturing overseas is in Saudi Arabia, and it's for killer drones. So, on that level, relations are very close. The autocratic leaders in the Middle East, probably all leaders in the Middle East, but certainly the autocratic leaders in the Middle East are on the one level delighted with Trump and his policy and his anti-Iranian stance, his lack of interest in human rights unless it fits other things he's trying to do. But on the other hand, Trump's unpredictable and he's unreliable. And so they need to hedge their bets and they need close ties to the Chinese. I think that what that means is that increasingly China will find it difficult to stay aloof of the multiple conflicts in the Middle East, and particularly the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And it, in my mind, Xinjiang is a potential powder keg for China in terms of relations, not only with the Middle East, but with the Muslim world at large. And I think the way to look at this is, you've had over the last few decades, a number of major incidents, the Salman Rushdie affair, the 2006 Danish cartoon affair, more recently, the evangelist preacher in Florida who burnt a Quran, in which basically there was an outcry from the Muslim world, whether it was the fatwa by Ayatollah Khomeini against Rushdie or the boycott by governments of Danish goods in 2006, or protests against the burning of the Quran. The thing to keep in mind is that all of these outbursts were sparked not by governments, but by protests, particularly protests by South Asians. Whether they were in Birmingham or in Pakistan didn't matter. And governments had to follow. What's happening in Xinjiang, or if all of these incidents were, sure, they were insulting, they were irritating, but they did not in any form or fashion threaten the faith. What's happening in Xinjiang is, in my mind, a frontal assault on the faith. And I cannot think of a comparable example, and probably to find one would have to go far back in history. And you have silence. Now, I think that silence is starting to be challenged, on the one hand, by the United States talking about sanctioning officials as well as companies involved in the crackdown in Xinjiang. But it's also starting to crack in the Muslim world. So you've had first demonstrations in Bangladesh and in India. You've seen a senior official in Prime Minister Mohammad Mahathir's government in Malaysia criticized the Chinese. And since then, Anwar Ibrahim, who most probably will be the next prime minister. And so I don't see how over time the Muslim world is going to be able to remain silent. They're obviously remaining silent, I think, for two reasons. One is the Chinese don't take kindly to criticism, and so they don't want to upset their relations, particularly because of the economics of it with China. But also, silence gives them leverage, because in being silent, they're enabling the Chinese.
So you, you highlight Xinjiang there, and obviously this has come up before, including on a previous podcast interview I did with Tom Cliff, and I'd point listeners in that direction with regard to talking about the really grievous and tragic situation in Xinjiang, which really everyone should be paying a great deal more attention to with regard to locking up Uyghurs and imprisoning them in re-education camps and so on. But it's also something that you bring out well in the book concerning the major players in the Middle East itself, Saudi Arabia and Iran notably, in terms of their historical relationship with Xinjiang, both in its own right and as a component of China. Could you perhaps say something about how Iran's approach and relationship over time to Xinjiang, and indeed Saudi Arabia's approach to the Xinjiang region and Muslims in China at large have evolved over the past few decades?
Well, let me put it in a larger context. China's relationship with Saudi Arabia is new. It goes back to the late 1980s. Up until then, China was an atheist communist regime, like the Soviet Union was, and the Saudis wanted nothing to do with it. That changed when, during the Iran-Iraq war, and the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, the Saudis very quietly for the first time bought missiles from China. And then with, obviously, as the opening in China progressed and the demise of communism in Europe, formal diplomatic relations were established and that relationship evolved. The relationship with Iran is far longer. There's far more in common. There are fewer threats, and in some ways, Iran has far more to offer the Chinese than the Saudis do. So, for one, you had, both of these countries were empires, and they were empires at the bookends of a massive continent. So they were not directly threatening to each other, and you had a lot of contact, and there's a lot of depth in that comes out of that. The Chinese also were, if you look at the ballistic missile industry in Iran, it's all built on a Chinese template. That's how they developed their missiles. China was helpful in initiating the nuclear program in Iran. And in the context of religion, and particularly Islam, in China, Muslims are a small minority, the 20 million in a population of more than a billion. But they're Sunnis. They're not Shiites. So religious proselytization or agitation was, the Saudis were much more concerned about, the Chinese were much more concerned about the Saudis, also because they represent an ultra-conservative strand of Islam, whereas there are no Shias, so the Iranians weren't a problem. That's one. I think also keep in mind that Xinjiang relationships and ties and linguistically, culturally, ethnically are with Turkey. They're not either with Iran or Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. That's not true for the Hui Muslims. in China, many of whom probably did come from Iran, but they no longer remember that. So that's what at one level. At the other level, Iran is a crucial link, land link, between China and Europe. It's a huge market, 80 million people, industrialized, even if the industry is in decay because of the sanctions and economic mismanagement, a highly educated population, and obviously a deep sense of identity, where Saudi Arabia has Mecca and money, and maybe in lesser amounts of money, given the financial issues that Saudi Arabia has. So I think at the end, the Chinese are trying to balance that relationship, and that's could become very difficult. The Americans are already trying to do that by imposing secondary sanctions. So Chinese companies dealing with Iran that have exposure to the United States or are dealing in U.S. dollars could get affected. But I've seen that over the last 2-3 years, there has been a significant amount of Saudi money going into militant and ultra-conservative madrasas or religious seminaries in the Pakistani province of Balochistan. And the Saudis have drafted plans to try and destabilize Iran by forging dissent among Iran's ethnic minorities, including the Baloch, who straddle the border of Iran and Pakistan. Now, those plans, so the building blocks are in place. Those plans remain on the drawing board. They, to the best of my knowledge, have not been taken off the drawing board, but they one day could be taken off the drawing board. And that would really strike fundamentally at Chinese interests, because Balochistan is the heart of the China-Pakistan economic corridor, which is a crown jewel of the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah, and I point listeners in the direction of that that Pakistan chapter in the book. You call it the Belt and Road's soft underbelly, and highlight in some detail there the vulnerabilities that you see in China's relationship with Pakistan and projects such as the Gwadar port and so on. But we have perhaps not sufficient time to delve into that in detail currently. So I'd just like to kind of, as we move towards a close, bring us back to some of the issues you were just raising there. I think when it comes to the question of how regional rivalries play off against one another and how China and, in addition, the United States interface with one another and with those regional rivalries in turn. You highlighted at the beginning, and actually what emerges throughout the book, is the fact that, as you say, this region is perhaps an arena in which China's entire approach to foreign policy is historically, at least on the surface, a non-interference doctrine and so on, may be forced into changing. And so I guess this brings up the question of values. And if you consider China's belief in win-win and non-interference and so on to be a sort of value, if you consider the United States' historic adherence, at least again on paper, to human rights discourse and so on, and if indeed you consider Saudi Arabia's interest in encouraging people to be Islamic in a certain way in this region, a sort of values-oriented stance, to what extent do you see this game or this conflict, as you term it, a collision between values per se, and to what extent are those values merely being leveraged against one another for naked economic benefit?
Well, first of all, I think, yes, you know, there is a clash of values, but I don't know that this is about values as such, at least not for the Chinese. I think the Chinese, in that sense, are much more pragmatic and it's about power, whether it's economic, geopolitical, military. I don't think, you know, if you are, and that's where why China is being forced to throw these principles out of the window. If you are a power with global interests rather than a power with only regional interests, then non-interference, the belief that economics can solve everything, and to a lesser extent, but nonetheless, foreign military presence are just not sustainable and not realistic. And I think, you know, China, as it from the opening up, grew and expanded and became far, far more powerful, and with a much larger stake in what happens outside of its borders, just simply because of the number of Chinese who live overseas. I mean, in the United Arab Emirates, they are probably about 15 to 20% of the population. And of course, the massive investments, none of that is sustainable. I would argue that the Trump administration is not about values, and if it's about values, it's about questionable values. But historically, the United States values did play a role in the United States, even if there were continuous contradictions in, on the one hand, upholding values, and on the other hand, in the policies that they were pursuing. But nonetheless, I think that, that values was part of the U.S. ethos, if you wish. So in that sense, I think that, that China is forced to change, and in doing so, no longer will be able to remain aloof to all kinds of rivalries and conflicts. I think the other thing about the about Xinjiang is what you're seeing in China. I mean, Xinjiang is first of all the harshest of a crackdown that goes far beyond Xinjiang and goes far beyond Muslims. It's a crackdown on religion, and Christians are experiencing the same thing. Now, they're not being locked up into en masse into political re-education camps, but nonetheless, they are experiencing crackdowns with arrests, with churches being torn down, and other things. But Xinjiang is important also in two other three other aspects. One, it today is the most extreme 21st century Orwellian surveillance state. The Chinese are going to roll out, call it Xinjiang Lite in terms of a surveillance state, in China itself. And where possible, and you're seeing that happen in Pakistan, they're going to try and export it. So that's one major consequence of Xinjiang that goes far beyond what is happening there on the ground. The second fallout is what I mentioned earlier. It's reshaping China's military posture. And China did not decided ultimately not to intervene militarily or with boots on the ground in Syria. But it's a matter of time before that starts to happen. And the third fallout has to do with, again, with a much broader issue, which is that China increasingly is trying to enlist the Chinese diaspora as its representatives, its lobbyists, and what have you. And that, if the Uyghur issue gets meshed into that, could cause societal strains in countries where you have both a Chinese and an Uyghur community or a Muslim community.
And I suppose my final question as we kind of wrap up is obviously you're drawing a picture here of, as you say, China becoming more embroiled in all of these situations and itself changing as a result. And in many ways, what you're portraying, unless I'm mistaken, is it China inevitably getting pulled into a lot of the situations that the United States has historically found itself in terms of being militarily entangled in regional situations and so on. As China's emergence in the region at large increases and deepens, are we building towards a situation where China simply becomes another US-like player here? Will there remain fundamental differences, as you see it, in both China's approach and the way it's perceived by local actors compared to the US and its sort of historically deeply involved role in the greater Middle East?
One, I think that in principle, yes, China is going to have a very similar experience to the United States in many ways. And you're seeing the rise of anti-Chinese sentiment, certainly in Central Asia. You go back to 2009 when there were riots in Xinjiang. The then Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan described it as genocide. You had attacks on the Chinese embassy in Ankara. In fact, the picture I wanted to put on the cover of my book, but I couldn't get the copyrights for it, was a picture of protesters in front of the Chinese embassy in Ankara walking over a Chinese flag on the ground. So that I think you will see that. Now, having said that, China has certain advantages. It doesn't have the history of the United States in the Middle East. And so therefore, it comes with a somewhat cleaner slate. Also, China has developed lobbies. But those lobbies are not, like in the United States, often they're interest lobbies. There are no ethnic lobbies in China, like you have in the United States with the Israeli lobby and the Turkish lobby and the Armenian lobby and the Greek lobby and so on and so forth. So in that sense, China has some advantages. Whether those advantages are sufficient to shield it from drawbacks and fallout, I would doubt.
Interesting. Well, that's a really great way to sort of end it, I suppose, with a somewhat open-ended question around quite, you know, where things will evolve. But I've no doubt that you'll be keeping a close eye on exactly how things do unfold in the coming years. So, James, we've taken up a lot of your time today, but before we let you go, perhaps I could ask a question which you, as a host in your turn, will be well familiar with. What is it that you're up to currently?
Well, book-wise, I'm finishing off two books at the same time. One is on the Pakistani-Saudi relationship, or what I somewhat cynically would describe as the Saudi wrecking ball in Pakistan. And the other is related to that, but much broader in the sense that it's about this, what people call Saudi funding. So, with other words, for 40 years or more than 40 years, Saudi Arabia has pumped immense amounts of money, estimates are about $100 billion, into supporting financially ultra-conservative Sunni Muslim cultural, religious, and educational institutions. And that has not in and of itself led to extremism or political violence, but it certainly contributed. And keep in mind that the mass bulk of Saudi funding did not go to violent groups. It's only five countries where the Saudis have funded violence. So that's what that second book is about. And for the rest, I obviously have my syndicated column and my and my blog.
Well, that all sounds fantastic, and certainly where the book projects are concerned, there are many issues there which undoubtedly have a bearing on China and East Asia at large too. So I'm sure listeners will be curious to keep a track of what you're up to in those areas. So James Dorsey, I'd just like to thank you very much for being on the show today. It was really excellent to have the chance to talk to you about this fascinating subject.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Great. Well, and listeners, thank you as ever for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. We will speak to you next time.